Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday. I'm going to try to do a piece on Pesach.
Talk about with ladies' class this morning. Anyway, for our sponsor, Abe Gluck in Lakewood, it's very hard because he remembers everything and can't use any refried beans. And now it turns out Kathy Pollock is the same way. So it's tough being in the podcast business. Anyway, I'll tell you something. I was reading the other day something about the Civil War for something I need for college. And I came across an idea hit me. I'm going to share it with you. Why were the 10 plagues? I'll cut right to it. Why were the 10 plagues? Why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu simply go? Why not Hashem make it, in other words? Go to tell Paro, look here. Let my people go or your son will die. Or you will. And to prove it, boom. You look at somebody and, you know, they drop dead. Something like that. Obviously, there's a reason. Now, you know, I've thought about this like you've thought about this over the years. And you kind of assume, Leman tesaber bozni bincho ben hrincha she'esashe, you know, salatim mitzrayim, that this way you'll be able to show off God's power. You know, that kind of thing. The nisim neflois. I mean, I get that. You know, that's what you call teretz. You know, I do hear it. But, yeah, so sufficient. Could have saved themselves a lot of trouble. You understand? He could, especially if it would be the Bechor of everybody at the time, but wouldn't only be Paro. You know, if they would have done that, the Egyptians would have folded, they would have to. Think about it. Instead, you had Domes, Radei, Kina, Marv, Dabashkin, and so forth. So why was it like that? So I'll tell you the truth. Never occurred to me before that I was doing some Civil War stuff, and it came into my mind, the famous words of Abraham Lincoln, the second inaugural. Everybody knows the Gettysburg Address. The second inaugural, in my opinion, is better. They're both good. Lincoln was a master of words. Doesn't matter if he's Jewish or not. He was a master of words and ideas. I mean, he really was. And he was a religious guy, even though he didn't belong to any particular church. And the second inaugural means that, just bear with me, that Lincoln was first elected in 1860, took office in March of 1861. There's a famous first inaugural address, I won't go into that. Then broke out the Civil War, which is an unbelievable catastrophe for North America, for the Americans. They all acknowledged that it was. I mentioned here before, I mentioned this morning, when the war broke out, and it was brother against brother, and state against state, and so forth, and the casualties ran up into the hundreds of thousands, and, you know, the Tovim Hayu Chalecher Michael Rov, there were, you know, a lot of civilian casualties, and the wounded, and the maimed, and all this kind of business. Remember, in those days, no anesthesia, so if they had to chop something off, they just did it. It was just terrible. And Farvos, what was it that made them say, oh, I'd rather go to war and get killed and this and that and the other than give in? Of course, it's slavery, you know. They tinted that it was states' rights and all that, but it's really slavery. I'll tell you why I'm going into this. And so the war broke out, and the Americans at that time were pretty religious Christians. And they asked themselves, the preachers and the ministers all said, why is God doing this to us? What is our sin? Now, what they did was what usually happens in a shrink's office or in a frum community also. You look for your avera of choice without looking for, you know, the real avera. You understand? A guy's a molester and a counterfeiter, and he skipped, you know, tachnun. oh, all this is happening because I skipped Tachlin. You know, like that. So they thought that because the United States was founded as a secular state instead of a Christian state, God is not mentioned in the Constitution. There's nothing about Yoshka there and so forth. This they thought was a big sin. That's why there was a big push in 1862, a big push to change the Constitution, make it a Christian country, not to hurt the Jews, just make it a Christian country, like Europe is, like England, for example, is. And, then the wrath of God will be withdrawn. This was resisted very heavily by Abraham Lincoln. It didn't happen, but he had to give in some way. He had to give in some, a little bit. And so he agreed that you should put God on the coins. That's why you have on the coins, "In God We Trust." Today, people think it's an idea of religiosity, and perhaps it is, but Lincoln and others viewed it as the opposite, because you shouldn't put God's name on something as dirty as money. All the averas in America happen with money. Not in Baltimore, of course, but everywhere else. Now, that's what they thought the sin was. But the war went on in 1861, 2, 3, and 4, and 5. And the casualties and the destruction went up and up and up. I mean, if you know what happened, I mean, the North was okay, but the South was a Corbin. Think about Sherman's march through Georgia. They burned everything and destroyed everything. And many other things like that. And so they're asking themselves, Mazos Asol Kim Lanu. Lincoln, by the time he did the second, so he was reelected in 1864, and the war was still going on. Some of the bloodiest fighting was even after the election. At that time, the president was sworn in not on January 20, but on March 4. So on March 4th, 1865, it's really a month before the South surrendered, but nobody knew it at the time. And the war was being fought very heavy and very bloody, in Virginia and Tennessee and all these other places. And towns are burned down, and it was terrible. Anyway, see, he was in his second inaugural, which is a short speech. You can look it up online. So he says, both sides appealed to God. Both sides thought they're right. But God could only answer one side. In other words, you have two people fighting. Each one thinks that they're on the side of right, that God is on their side. But you turn out in the end, you find what it is. And he says, does it make sense? I mean, I'm paraphrasing. That the South is suffering so much and such a korban to keep slaves is not going to die. You understand? The whole point of slaves is you have a certain luxury, a certain economic system, so on and so forth. I mean, I get that. But not at the price that you lose your husband, your father, your brother, your children, which is what was happening. I mean, is it worth that? Are you so in love with your car that you're willing to give up your family so you can keep your car? Where's the common sense? Alpha became, the South went on fighting. It's interesting. They were losing, Yom Havilah, thousands and thousands of the white people. And for what? And the funny thing is, Rove of the South didn't own slaves. It was a few. The rich, the richy rich, and some of the middle class. That's all. Most people in the South didn't own slaves. After all, you can hire somebody. There's such a thing called a maid, And imagine how much a maid was at that time. Anyway, so it's funny that they dug in their heels and they wouldn't give in and so on and so forth. Didn't make any sense. And to tell you the truth, if you know your history, even in the South, they were starting at the very end of the war, like in 1864 and all that, to start to have cheshbonis. It just never developed into anything real. In the South, they started to say, why don't we free the slaves and recruit them in the Southern Army and use them to defeat the Northern Army? Because Lincoln is using all the blacks that they liberated slaves and put them in the Union Army. He has 200,000 black soldiers, which were of great use in the war. 200,000, right? I don't know if the South had probably total 200,000 or something like that. Plus he had the white men, plus he had the immigrants, the Irish and the others. That's where Lincoln had so many, soldiers. Draft was a big problem in the Civil War. They had a draft law, But nor did the middle class children protest like they did over here in Vietnam. If you paid, I think, $1,000, you'd get a substitute. So every family put up $1,000 who could afford it, and they got a substitute. It was legal. It was written into law. So, but the South was going crazy. So at the end, they said, even Robert E. Lee, you know, in fact, the guy who thought it up with Judah Benjamin, but not only him, General Claiborne. The point is, thinking people in the South said, Ulay Esher, this is a mistake. Maybe we should get rid of the slavery system and use the blacks to fight for us, promising their liberty if they go for us. It never happened, Lamaisa. At the very, very end of the war, when it was way too late, they started to maybe Ulay Esher a little bit. But not really. So why am I mentioning this? That's the context in which Lincoln is giving his second inaugural address. You'll see what this has to do in Pesach in a minute. And in there, he's saying, what's the shot that this war is going on so long? Why does he want this? And he says, I can only come to the following conclusion. I'll quote you. It's two or three sentences. But with Lincoln, the language is very crafted, very precisely, very artistically. So listen closely. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled up by the bondsmen's or slavery owners, 250 years of unrequited toil, shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drop of blood drawn with the sword, then, as was said 3,000 years ago, so must it be said today, Mishpatei Hashem emes tzadku yachav, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That's a powerful idea. And what he's saying is, the only way he can be masbir, as an American, that the South is clearly losing and being destroyed, yesterday should uphold the system of slavery, is only min hashamayim. And should be mida keneged mida, that the wealth piled up by the bondsmen 250 years of unrequited toil, that the South built up a whole South on the slavery, the plantations, you know, all that stuff. The richy riches lived it up. And the slaves to support them, you know, like going with the wind. And I always say, the third biggest economy in 1861 in the world, the third biggest economy in the world was Mississippi. The slavery worked very well. Thank you. So, let's say for argument's sake, they made $500 million for the slavery. So Lincoln is being masbir. It's like this. This war is going on so long. They're burning and destroying so much in the South, killing so many people, that the amount of nezek in the South is $500 million. Oh, mida keneged mida. You took $500 million of profit from the hard labor of the slaves, so you lose $500 million of profit. You know, that kind of idea. Or every drop of blood drawn with the lash. All the tortures that they did upon the black slaves, which they did. And, you know, they whipped them and so forth. Shall now be paid with blood drawn by the sword. In other words, you took out their blood by whipping them. Now you lose your blood in the battlefield, in the battles with the North. If this is true, if this is the shot, then at least I understand what's going on. It's a punishment by God, says Abraham Lincoln. And it's Mishpatei Hashem emes tzadku yachav. That's what he said. You know, like you say, Mishpatei emes tzadku yachav on Simchas Torah. Now you see the Moshel and the Nimshel. Because this is, it seems to me, this is probably shot. I haven't seen anybody say this exactly, but it must be somebody. It's very Sephardic. Why did they have, before the Jews leave Egypt, Esther Malkus, if you think about it, they're 9-1. The last Malkus was the biggie. But the one before that was basically economic. You understand? All the rest of it. Mamish wrecked up the economy. Put yourself into that time. Think about when all the animals died. Or think about if you can't do anything during Chayshu for 3 days. People die. Animals die. Right? You got to feed them. Crops are unattended to. You know what I mean? It's rough. if everything turns into Dom, if there's Svardei all over the place, you can't go anywhere, and so forth. And so, the Rebbeinu Shlomo is saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, 1 year from now, approximately, they're going to leave. But before they leave, I'm going to make it that every penny the Mitzrayim made out of the 86 years of slavery, hard labor, of the Bnei Yisrael, is going to be blown away. See? So if they made it, for argument's sake, if they made a billion off the labor of the Jews, between the dominance of Ardain, the Kim, and the other stuff, they lost a billion. I'll say it again. You tell me what happened when the hail hit the fields. What kind of economic loss was that for the Mitzrayim? You tell me what happened economically when everybody even gets covered with kinnin and they can't do any work because they're freaking out. And it goes for a week or something like that. 7 days without any work because you're covered with the kinnin. Or the shechin. Or the arbe. Right? That's the easy one. How much damage, even today, countries once in a while get a locust plague or a boll weevil or something like that. You know? And now you have DDT and the modern stuff to fight it. And even so, if it gets hit with the wrong thing, it's an agricultural disaster. We are lucky in North America, you know, if there's not food in one state, so there's a food, they send in food from another state, so you pay a little bit more. Right? If there's a problem in Maryland, you send in food from Florida, or vice versa. But not in those days. If there was a locust plague in Egypt, bye-bye. Bye-bye. I don't know, and you don't know, how they recovered ever from the locust plague losing all their crops. I don't know, and you don't know, what this did to the economic situation of Mitzrayim, but I can imagine. And Libby, I'm really, that it's probably Mita Kenegamina. Like Lincoln's saying, that why was there a dumps where they came and all the rest of it? Since you and I know that in 10, 11 months, he's going to have to let everybody go anyway, because the Makas Bechoris is going to be a game changer. It's going to be a deal breaker. He's not going to be able to resist that. He literally will not be able to resist that. So why not go to that right up front? So it seems that he's saying it's like this. Mitzrayim thought that they could enslave you and get money out of you, because that's what slavery is supposed to be about. No. Every penny they made will be blown. Imagine a guy scheming away. We used to have movies like this when I was a kid. I remember Treasure of Sierra Madre and all that. They steal for something like that. They rob a belt of gold, and then by the time it's over, the gold was lost. So all that was for nothing. All the Gneva Gzela and all the rest of it was for nothing. That's like the biggest to come on somebody, get? Imagine a swindler makes a lot of money and then loses it all in some dumb way. All the swindling and everything else was for nothing. It's all for nothing. Imagine how the person feels. He says, that's how Mitzrayim felt. And that was a certain chama for the slaves. Did Bnei Yisrael realize when they're leaving Egypt, and maybe, I don't know exactly, how can I, when it says you should take out the gold and silver from Mitzrayim, all the rest of it, was that wages for their work? That's, they say that in the Gemara. Well, then if it's wages for their work for so and so many years, that's on top of the fact that he lost an equal amount, you see what I'm saying, in the nine plagues. So notice they got a double. If they made a billion off the Jews, hard labor, so first of all, they gave a billion on the way out, kesev azov and all that, you know, clay kesev, clay zov is smallest. And moreover, they lost a billion in income because of the nine plagues. In which case, Paro felt not only defeated, but stupid. Stupid. Which must have enraged him to a crazy degree. And it's probably the explanation why he did something so nutty as chasing him out to the Yamsuf. Didn't you realize what happened to you? But we all know the story. It's a human being story. Couldn't deal with the fact. Not only are they getting away, but they messed me over financially. Man, they made the whole 86 years of the slavery a brachal batol in terms of, you know, the economic profit, where slavery is supposed to be economic profit. Otherwise, why do you enslave people? Now, I'm not entirely right, because one of the reasons you enslave people, or can be anyway, is for sadism, for punishment. I mean, the Nazis tortured the Jews for both reasons, right? It wasn't only about money. It was partly that. And the Germans were very successful in using the Jews and other captured people as slave labor. Free labor is worth gold, as the expression goes, which is true. But not only, was it like that, but they enjoyed doing it. They had enough from being torturers and sadism. We know this. So the same thing with Mitzrayim. If they made a vote as Parach and all the other things like that, so then part of it was Parach to break people's back. Part of it was killing children in the rivers. That's part of it was a pure cruelty. If it's a cruelty, that will come with the Makas Bechoris. I say that because Makas Bechoris, I got to tell you something interesting. I never noticed this before. Hold on one second. Here it is. I just opened this Haggadah. I just took out all my Haggadahs this morning. All 700 of them. And there's one that the art school put out, I think. No, Feldheim. Ki Yishalcha, you must have seen it. That's the one the art school translated in the Haggadah with answers or something. Some title like that. And it's in the form of questions and answers. And did a very good job. I've mentioned in the past, after Feldheim did it, and they're in a good group, and this guy who put this Haggadah together looks to me like a Mizrahi type guy, so it must be very good quality. Anyway, so in there, if you're interested, you can get this Haggadah. Probably many of you listening have this Haggadah. And it's called Yishalcha from Vilovsky. And on page 240, 241, he asked a question in very short bursts. So I don't know where he got everything from. I'm sure it's from a Makar. I don't know where he got everything from. But he says, Mahaya Anisim B'makas B'choris. He went through all the 10 plays. And the one I want to call your attention to, I'll just read it to you very quickly. Doesn't hurt. Mahaya Anisim B'makas B'choris. So according to the Medrash, I'm just reading what he says. From Shmos Rabbah, Gam HaMitzriyos HaMu'ubaros Mesu, She'apil Si'adim Shai B'chorim. That not only the firstborn who are alive, but the firstborn who are about to be born. Okay? The Mubaris. So, okay. Then the Menesh HaGadol says, this is disgusting. A club motzi was atzmos ha-bachorim she-nifru zman rab lefnei kim be-ru lefnei be-sorein. That meis kol b'chor be-sorein, even the b'chorim who had died in previous years, the dogs pulled out their bones from the cemetery and threw them in front of the house of the parents or the grandparents or the great grandparents. That's weird. The Beis Halevi, he says Gufas Abachorim Nirkavu, Bishil is Pasha Magefa Gadol Kiltram Mitzrayim. That's an interesting suggestion. I don't know where he gets it from. That's an interesting suggestion. If the Bechor died here and the Bechor died there and the Bechor died there, so you had a whole bunch of dead bodies. When you have a whole bunch of dead bodies, it begins a plague. You understand? Because the body corrupted, gets germs and all this stuff, and becomes a plague. Which is true. And since there was a sudden death of all the Bechorim, so it broke out a plague, and the plague killed a lot of other Egyptians from the plague. You know what I mean? Like bubonic plague. And what else is he saying? And then it says that this one you know. So Bechorim Mitzrayim, Shel Zomal, Seribu, Shel Paral, Shachas, Mitzirah, Hikus man again. That's the idea of Makab Mitzrayim Bechor saying that the firstborn attacked their parents because why are you doing this to us? That's just an interesting thing. One last one before I go back on that. I never heard that before. Right? I've never noticed that before. That it wasn't only the Bechor who died. What is this? Sorry. My phone is playing tricks. It wasn't only the Bechor who died, but if there wasn't a Bechor in the family, in other words, let's say, for argument's sake, a person's father was not a Bechor. So there's no Bechor in the family. So the father died. The Godel Shel Bavayis or something like that. Right? In which case, a lot more than just the Bechor. These are all classic, Parshanisha, Midrashic types of things. But Parshat Shot, when Moshe says, Meis Kol B'chor B'Eretz Yisrael, so let's say you're an Egyptian, and let's say you're B'chor, and this guy Moshe has a track record. 9 times he predicted it would be a plague, and 9 times it happened. Right? He said it happens, going to happen. And now he says to Pharaoh, either let my people go, as I've been demanding, or Meis Kol B'chor B'Eretz Yisrael. This is said before it happens. So it's unbelievable. The paro, his mama's shelev. Person, no, I'm not going to let him go. So if I was a Bechor living a block away, I said, what the heck is with you? It's like Abraham Lincoln saying, what, in order to keep your slaves, you're going to lose your own people? Is retaining your slaves more important to you than your own son? That's what you're saying? And if the older generation went along with this, if Paro was able to get away with this, I guess the adults agree with him. They're all angry at the Jews, whatever. If you're a kid and you know, based on the track record of this guy Moses, in 3 days we're all toast, or a week, whatever the amount of time was, we're all toast. We're going to go. Which did happen, by the way. So how would you regard your family? You say the heck with me, I say the heck with you. You say I shouldn't live, then I say you shouldn't live. What? We should keep this Jewish slave here, or slaves, even if it costs my life? Like, what kind of richy riches are you? What kind of families are you? I mean, is mom and mom is your God? You know, it's unbelievable. This compelled them to question the entire justification for the system, the way I told you before it happened in the American South. By the time you get to the late Civil War, they said, what's the justification for losing all these people in order to maintain the institution of slavery, right? Now, the interesting thing is, that argument didn't work on Pharaoh. Because you know, I know he didn't let the people go, and the Malchus Taka came on the night of Pesach and killed everybody. And if you follow all these Mefarshim I just told you, he killed a lot more than this to Bechors, right? Either a bubonic plague or something like that broke out in some fashion or another, or Babai Shem Bechor Nerag or Golish of Babais. However you interpret it, it was a major bummer. You see, but did it affect Paro himself? Well, once they died, I think Paro's situation became untenable. You understand? No, this is too much. And there is a chazal that says that he was afraid he's a firstborn. Therefore, it's going to hit him also. Oh, when it comes to your own Dalet Amos, then it's a different story. That everybody else's Bechor should die in order to retain the slavery system, that's okay. Not me. It reminds me very much, I mentioned this morning, of the story of the surrender of Japan in 1945. For those who know what actually happened. Not the generalists. You know, the U.S. was going to invade Japan. The Japanese were not going to surrender. They planned. They had a swara. The swara was, they don't mind, there were like 70, 80 million Japanese, something like that. They don't mind losing a couple million. Said the emperor and the big shots, lose a couple million. But in order to kill a couple million, the Americans will have to lose a million or so. America can't take a million casualties. You understand? The system can't handle that. Not in a democracy. We see this now. The America's cracking under the Gaza war. They can't handle that. So it's not a bad spark. You have to be very ruthless and say, I don't care if a million or 2 million or 10 million of my own people get killed. But they're ruthless like that. The Emperor Hirohito and the other dukes and the princes and the generals and the admirals and all this junk, they didn't care what the people downstairs below them thought. You get it? And that's why even when America said, oh, we'll make an end run around you and we'll create something called A-bomb. We have Jewish scientists that make A-bomb. Oppenheimer. And they made 2 A-bombs. So in 1945, the U.S. had a grand total of 2 A-bombs. They didn't have more because they didn't have enough uranium or whatever it takes to do it. Nobody's supposed to know that. And they figured when they dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, beginning of August, I think, of 45, the Japanese would be so shocked. They'll say, we surrender. It didn't happen. They said, the heck with that. So you wiped out a city. And a few days later, they dropped another bomb in Nagasaki. They said, oh, now Japan will definitely, because they're afraid to get the cities wiped out. Next, get tug. The Japanese did not surrender. Right? Not surrender. They didn't care. It's only because in the day they dropped the bomb in Nagasaki, Russia entered the war, Stalin attacked them, and Soviet troops started to land in place in Japan. Then they surrendered right away. Why? Because they were afraid of Stalin. The opposite. They were afraid of Stalin in the sense that the Russians come in and the communists take over, they'll overthrow the emperor and all the nobles and everybody will get killed. All the big shots will get killed and replaced by a communist government. The way they did in other places when they had communist revolutions, they killed the whole ruling class. You know how the communists work. Oh, when it's my own Dalai Lama's, when it's me, myself, and I, that's a different story. They immediately surrendered to America. Get it? Because they wouldn't surrender to Russia. Surrendered to America so that the communists would stay out, away from Japan. And it worked, by the way. So it wasn't the A-bomb. It was the entry of Russia into the war. Even America didn't drop the atomic bombs. The fact that Russia entered the war and started landing troops and they were fighting in certain Japanese islands. Because if you look at the map, Russia is not so far away. Vladivostok is not far away from Japan. That would drove them crazy. And they said, oh, we're going to lose our privileged position, our lands, our possessions, our family status, and all the rest of it. That's exactly what happened with Paro. So it's very interesting. You see, the Esther Makis are there to drain every last penny that they made from the slaves. On top of that, Hashem told them, that's not enough. I want you to take out the money that you earned through your slave labor. So then it was a double loss. You get it? Because first of all, the restaurant failed. Second of all the profit you made, over the course of 2 years running a restaurant was lost based on the lawyer bills, right? All the money gone. And thirdly, you had to pay the creditors or something like that. And so the same amount went out twice. How does that person feel? It feels like I'm an idiot, chip idiots. I never should have messed with this business in the first place. That is exactly how the Rabbanu Shalom wanted Mitzrayim to feel. And he wanted the Jewish people to know that, because that's the only way you get some kind of psychological revenge on your oppressors. At least that's what I think. Anyway, I think it's a true Yisod. We'll have to call that the Pirush of Abraham Lincoln. Anyway, with that, I wish you all a good week. I hope this is not refried beans.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.